Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hello all and welcome to another episode of At The Margin. Today I'm joined by Fergal O'Connor, Finance Lecturer at University College Cork. Fergal is an expert in gold and other precious metals. We go through everything you wanted to know about gold. We discuss the historical reasons why gold is valuable and how this has translated into the modern world. We go through the various economic drivers and we also touch on other related commodities such as Bitcoin. Fergal really knows his stuff and is very easy to listen to, so I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. He gives us some insight into the various market trends and investment strategies, and I make a few jokes throughout that we're not giving any investment advice, but maybe I should make that clear. We're not giving any investment advice. We accept no liability for any losses incurred if you decide to follow any investment strategy on follow this podcast. We will, however, accept any contributions if you make any money following this podcast. Speaking of contributions, the Patreon page is at patreon.com/@themargin. That's at the margin, all one word, and Patreon is spelled P-A-T-R-E-O-N. If you like what you hear and would like to throw a few bob in the tip jar, then take a look at the Patreon. There's some bonus content, hot takes, as a young kid say, and a bit of career chat over there as well. Some new content coming soon. Okay, I hope you enjoyed this chat with Fergal.
Okay, well, I suppose just to start off, if we're thinking about gold, a lot of people will wonder where the value of gold came from in the first place, because it seems to be just this piece of metal that seems to be a lot prettier than the other metals. How has it become so valuable, and how has it become this benchmark of value, of store value that we have today?
Yeah, so I mean, part of gold's allure in terms of its long-term value to people is just how rare it is relative to everything else. So even in terms of the precious metals, if you think about gold and silver, there's about 7 or 8 times as much silver mined in history as there is gold. So silver is way more common than gold. And especially if you go back far enough in history, gold was incredibly rare. So the first example we have of gold jewelry is from about 6,500 years ago. But that would have been gold that was just kind of collected as it floated down a river. It wasn't mined gold. So in all of history, you've got kind of 200,000 tons of gold. That's probably surprising if you think about it in terms of size. It's about a 21-meter cube. That's all the gold we've ever found in history. And gold is unusual then in the sense that it doesn't corrode in any way. So if you find some gold coins from a Roman period in a ditch tomorrow when you're out digging in your garden and you run them under a tap, those gold coins are going to be shiny straight away, whereas every other metal will obviously have corroded a little bit. There'll be a little bit of rust or whatever. Even silver will corrode a little bit. So it's incredibly pure, you know, it's incredibly non-reactive. Nice. It's also incredibly ductile and easy to work with. So really early gold work, if you go back kind of 3,000-5,000 years ago, they just sort of been hammering it onto other gold and it just kind of bonds onto it because it's so soft. It's got nice uses then in modern times. It has nice uses in terms of some electronics. You get a little bit of gold in electronics because it's quite a good conductor. And it's one of the biggest telescopes that's been built recently. That's actually the mirror in the telescope is lined with gold because it's such a good reflector. Right. So gold has lots of kind of unusual physical characteristics in terms of its chemistry, but its value, its long-term value, is based on how rare it is relative to kind of other precious metals.
Right, okay.
And how long-lasting it is.
Okay, so there was always a historical value in that it was rare and that you could use it, and then as well as just being pretty. So how did that translate then into maybe the value we place on it now in terms of the way it was used maybe to back currencies and the way we have it now as maybe an investment? Where did it go from maybe that historical concept to maybe the more modern value that we place on it?
Yeah, so it wasn't money until about 500 BC. So the first gold coins that we found come from Lydia in about 500 BC, and they would have a king's head stamped on and all that. Before that, they were just pretty, like you said. And that's part of the value of gold, is that it is pretty, right? That people want it, and that means it has a kind of a demand and use that other commodities don't, in terms of you're prepared to keep it around. Like, nobody invests in a barrel of oil and puts it in their basement for 50 years, or, you know, gold is different because people want to keep it for long periods of time and look at it, buy a piece of jewellery and keep it for a long period. How it became money is, I suppose, a little bit of accident more than anything else. So silver was really what people used as money. Gold is too valuable to carry around in your pocket. If you were kind of an ordinary peasant in England or Ireland or somewhere like that 500 years ago, you wouldn't have been carrying on gold, because you couldn't have bought anything. Like, it was too valuable as a coin. It'd be worth too much to buy anything that you'd be buying. So you would have been using silver and other metals. We ended up on a gold standard because of Isaac Newton, of all people, when he was the director of the Royal Mint in the UK. He set the price, the ratio, I suppose, of the price of gold to silver in such a way that the price in Britain was slightly higher for gold than it was in Europe. And then, you know, you get your speculators and arbitrageurs, and they were in Europe, they would move their gold from mainland Europe and they'd exchange it for silver, and the gold flowed into Britain. Britain ended up with a huge amount of gold relative to other countries. Britain goes on the gold standard, and then, you know, the world ends up on the gold standard, but not for as long a period, I think, as people think. You get the classical gold standard before World War One. It didn't last for hundreds of years. It was quite, you know, for the world, it was quite a short period. And once World War One comes along, you know, people flit on and off gold here and there, but it's not really as the gold standard isn't as long term and stable an idea for the world as maybe it kind of feels like when you read about it.
Yeah, and just, I suppose, for the non-economist, gold standard is where we had the currency was backed by a reserve of gold, and then we moved off that, and it was like fiat, what's known as fiat money.
Yeah, and it was literally exchangeable for gold. So you could take your £1 note and you could go into the Bank of England and they would give you whatever that was worth in gold up until a certain period. So it was literally, you know, you could exchange it. And people did use gold coins as currency around at those times as well. But it would have been, you know, for big purchases, you know, it would have been for large purchases. You wouldn't have been using gold coins for your day-to-day activities, I suppose. Yeah.
One thing that I always often wondered is that, you know, like, the use of gold as a currency, or sorry, the use of any currency, is that it's a store of value and you can use it as a means of trade. And it's the value is based on, you know, the confidence that you can exchange it and somebody will accept it. And if it's maybe, you know, paper money, you know, it's just a piece of paper, but it's a promise backed by the government that this will be honoured. And I have a lot of confidence that most of the time that the government will honour that promise. But with gold, that promise seems to be based on the confidence that the other person believes it has value. There isn't maybe the centralised form of value. So are we sort of relying on the fact that everybody else believes that it has value for it to have value? Is there like an emperor's new clothes element to it?
Yeah, I mean, and this is something I've had a few debates with people about in relation to Bitcoin as well and gold and things like that. Because you have made the point there that, you know, modern money is fiat money. We believe it's money and that's what gives it its value. And people think of gold then as being a hard currency because I can go into the bank and I can exchange my money for gold, or I could back in, like, you know, 1900 in London. Mm-hmm. But gold only has value because people believe it has value, right? We know it has a certain amount of value because people like jewellery and people like having it. And like I said, there's a little bit that goes into electronics and things like that. But again, to me, all currencies end up being fiat in the end. They only work as long as you believe in them. Like, fiat currency systems usually fail in the long run, but so do gold currency systems. So They're all based on belief and faith in the currency, in whatever's there. And gold brings its own problems as a currency, because you don't have control over how much of it there is. So you can't reduce the supply of it that easily. You know, you can't, and you certainly can't increase the supply of it that easily, because there's only so much that you can dig out of the ground. So its benefit as a hard currency is also kind of its problem then, when you get a lot of economic growth and things like that. If you don't, if you're on a gold standard, you have to keep revaluing what your gold is worth in order to stop getting kind of deflation, which is, you know, the problems that the world faced around the 1930s.
And so what is the modern role for gold, I suppose, in an investment portfolio? Why does somebody include gold in their investment, as opposed to maybe, say, Apple shares or shares in Amazon, where you might be expecting a return on your investment, as opposed to maybe gold, where it's gold is gold, basically, you know, it just sits there.
Yeah, I mean, gold is a cost, if you think of it in one way, because if you buy a bar of gold and you put it in a vault in London, you're going to have to pay that vault to mine the gold, you have to insure the gold. So gold actually costs a certain amount of money. If you own physical gold, it costs you a certain amount of money to actually own it. So it's almost the complete opposite of owning a share, where you do get an interest payment. Now, central banks, there is a market where you can lend gold, but it's only really central banks lend gold. They lend it to gold miners and to jewelers and people like that. So there are ways of earning interest on gold, but it's really not for the common investor, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So yeah, why would anyone want to own gold? I suppose that's what interests me in terms of doing research about the gold market. It is one of the confusing things, especially when I started doing research on it. Why would anyone want to buy an inert metal that isn't really, you know, it isn't really that useful on a grand scale? It's too expensive to use in industrial kind of industrial applications on any large scale. Even in dentistry, they don't use gold much anymore because it's too expensive, and they have cheaper alloys they can use instead for making their gold teeth. So the reason you would buy gold is, I suppose, it's really simple in one way, because gold is economically inert, because the value of gold isn't really based on how well a business is doing or how much economic growth there is or anything like that. It's kind of economic inertia makes it a really good diversifier in your portfolio. So if you look at how gold reacts to stock market movements and things like that, it tends not to react that strongly. So particularly when you get really bad days on the stock market, gold doesn't tend to have as bad a day, and then it tends to pick up in value a lot quicker than the stock market. So if you mix a little bit of it into your portfolio, if you buy some gold, so not, I don't mean kind of 50% of your investment capital going into gold, but if you put, you know, somewhere between 2 and 10%, there's no solid answer on how much you should put in your portfolio, but if you put a small amount of gold in your portfolio, it does have a benefit where it kind of dampens down any volatility, any kind of big swings up and down in the value of your portfolio. And over the long run, even though it sometimes will give you lower returns, sometimes it'll give you higher returns, over the long run, what you tend to get is higher risk-adjusted returns. So the return you're getting per unit of risk you take in your investment is higher. So, you know, kind of classical finance theory, modern finance theory, says that you should try and maximize your return per unit of risk. And that's what putting gold into your portfolio does. So it's not so much to drive, you know, you should always have some gold in your portfolio because gold is a diversifier. There's times where you might want to speculate in gold because you think the price will go up. But you should always have some there. There's kind of the always argument, and it's just a diversification argument. So if you want to diversify your portfolio, you should own a bit of everything. And gold is actually a huge investment market when you start looking at the numbers on it.
Right. And the layperson might think then, well, why wouldn't you just not? So if you, for example, you're thinking, okay, I have a certain amount of money I want to invest, and I put an X amount in this share, X amount in that share, but I'll save aside this amount for investing in gold. Is gold is obviously better than just leaving it in cash. It gives you more diversification than in cash.
Yeah, because so if you look at how gold kind of acted during the global financial crisis, when stock markets did very poorly, and then during the kind of 2011 crisis in Europe, gold went up and up and up and up. So what tends to happen is in a time of crisis, people will be selling off the riskier assets they own. So they'll sell off maybe their shares and things like that, things that are more sensitive to the kind of general economy. And they tend to put their money then into safe havens, so places where the money is kind of, there's a low return, but it's a very secure investment. So they'll invest in things like government treasury bills and things like that. So they'll lend their money to the government. They'll get a really low, or at the moment, even a negative interest rate, but then their money's safe, right? It's not going to, the company's not going to go bankrupt. The government will repay the money, and gold is one of the places that money tends to flow. So it goes into kind of the US treasury market. It goes into, people put money in the Swiss franc, they put it into the Japanese yen. So it's kind of really safe economies. They tend to put their money there when markets are doing badly. So it's that kind of, it's that low or negative correlation that you're looking for in your portfolio. And there will be times when you have gold in your portfolio and it loses you money, right? Gold goes down in value. But I can't remember the name of the famous hedge funder who has the quote, but he says, if you like everything in your portfolio, then you're not diversified. Everything's a speculation then. You have to have something in there you don't like, because you need to be ready for the day that you're wrong, right?
Yeah. That makes it, actually, that's great advice. I never heard that before.
Yeah.
But
and it's actually, there's kind of a weird reason. If you go reading about this afterwards, you'll find some kind of prominent market commentators in the Wall Street Journal and places like that who've written since, because March was the last time you had a big stock market turmoil and things like that. And they've pointed out that in the first day or two that the stock market was going down, gold went down too, right? And they're like, well, gold is obviously a terrible safe haven. You shouldn't put your money there because it went down with the stock market. Yeah. But what tends to happen is, for a day or two, gold acts as a source of liquidity. So gold isn't currency, right? It's not money anymore in the way that maybe it once was, but it's pretty close. And the weird thing that gold did for a long time was, if you were a market trader in London, if you sold your gold, you get paid T+2. So you get paid 2 days later. The cash gets to your bank account 2 days later. That's the kind of settlement date for it. But equities were T+3. So if you had a margin call or something where you owed money to your broker because of changes in the price of your stocks, but if you needed cash because of a stock market downturn, having gold was similar to having cash, because if you sold your gold, you'd get the cash before you needed it to pay your equity bill, if you know what I mean.
Right.
And that meant that for a day or two at the beginning of any crash, gold goes down. But then once those who kind of need to sell gold to get cash have been flushed out or whatever, you know, once people have sold their equity, that money then flows into gold and it tends to go up. So it's kind of a delayed reaction. For a day, it doesn't go down as much. It might go down a little bit, but if you look at it kind of a week later,
then the price,
gold has really kind of protected the value of your portfolio, or at least reduced the fall of the value of your portfolio after a week later or a month later.
Okay, that's interesting. So if things go bad, would that be the time to buy then? And then when the price is slightly depressed and then... Well, anyway, that's, sorry.
No investment advice.
No, yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, I mean,
no, I'm just thinking
out loud. If you look back through it, if you were able to buy gold kind of a day after a crash, it tends to have kind of dropped a little bit. You might get a little bit of a bargain, and then the price should rise after that. And that's what happened since March. You know, gold broke all time records for the value of gold in dollars. About a month ago, a little bit more than a month ago, it broke $2,000 an ounce. Went down a little bit since, but that's all on the back of worries about coronavirus.
Right.
Like,
I put a disclaimer at the end. Don't worry, we won't be on the hook for any comments.
we'll do the little disclaimer.
One thing that as well. So people look at investment and you hear a lot of common story. Okay, gold was perhaps, you know, it goes up in value when times are bad. And then people think that maybe there's a bargain to be had if to go for silver or other precious metals. How do they respond? Are they a similar safe haven, or do they behave slightly differently, or what way do they respond maybe in relation to gold?
Yeah, so I mean, silver is a close kind of is the closest. So the four big precious metals are gold, silver, platinum, and palladium. Platinum and palladium are a little bit different because they have a big industrial use. So the filtration systems or whatever in petrol and diesel cars use platinum and palladium. And in fact, so palladium has been an amazing investment over the last 10 years, because they've used more and more of it in cars. So that price has gone through the roof relative to the other ones, but for different reasons. So that's purely kind of a little bit like, it's like any commodity, right? If people demand lots more oil, then the price of oil goes up. So platinum and palladium, they're precious kind of chemically, if you know what I mean, but they're not precious in the sense of being money. And the reason is, it does. So if you think of it this way, all the gold that's ever been mined is actually still available to us as gold. Like some of it's at the bottom of the sea in a ship, but yeah, it's still there, it's still gold. Whereas silver gets used, silver had a lot of uses in photography. It gets used in photovoltaic cells and things like that. So they have kind of a big industrial component, and there's a big demand for silver, platinum, and palladium industrially, whereas gold doesn't have, its industrial demand is quite small. So silver is like gold. It does react a little bit similarly, but it's almost like gold that's kind of... It's hyperactive gold. So when gold goes up, silver tends to go up by more. When gold goes down, silver tends to go down by more. And probably the reason for that is that gold isn't a central bank metal anymore. So one of the, you know, gold is no longer money. It's no longer backing your money. When I teach students, when I teach down here in UCC about money, I always ask students what they think about money, get them to write it down. And always a few will tell me that, you know, their money is backed by gold. So there's still this impression people have, whereas silver is not, central banks don't own silver anymore. And that kind of, I think that lack of that, or there's a difference in confidence in that gold is still a vaguely monetary metal. You know, central banks in the last few years have been increasing the amount of gold they own. And the Federal Reserve and the Treasury in the US have never really stopped selling their gold in the 70s. And have just kept it. So they have an enormous stock of gold. The German government, the Italian government, they have large stocks of gold as well. Ireland only has a small amount of gold. But they act differently. There's differences in the research around whether silver is a safe haven or not. I'd say the problem with any, like, there's good theoretical reasons why gold would be a safe haven, right? So we know it flows into it because we know it flows into it because it's form of safety. We know central banks own it, and we can all, you know, I have that reason where you can get your money more quickly from the gold market. So I can see why gold is a safe haven. I don't see a strong theoretical reason why silver would be. And silver is quite sensitive then in terms of it gets affected by industrial production a little bit more, so it wouldn't be as strong a safe haven.
Yeah, no, that came to mind there when you mentioned it, that if it's used in industrial processes and if there's an economic shock, well, it's going to some of that signal is going to be transferred into the price of silver, it seems, compared to gold.
It's also just a much smaller market. Every day in the world, $145 billion is transacted in the gold market,
right.
which is an enormous amount of money,
yeah,
for one shiny metal, whereas you're talking about a tiny fraction of that. For silver,
and that would make
it's not as valuable,
and that would make it more volatile, I'd imagine.
Yeah, it is way more volatile. Putting it into a portfolio, it's just a much more volatile asset, and gold itself is actually quite a volatile asset. It wouldn't seem like something that would you know, improve the stability of your portfolio if you look at the price. But it's when you mix it in, it's the lower negative correlation that kind of causes that.
So one thing then that people might be interested in is cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin and all the other types of cryptocurrencies. There's a lot of talk that they're perhaps being used as some sort of a safe haven.
So I haven't done any work on it, but I've seen colleagues and friends who do work on cryptocurrencies, and there's obviously certain similarities between them. I mean, if you think about Bitcoin, you have that picture that's always shown for Bitcoin, which is a gold coin, which I always think is kind of funny, that they're showing a physical asset for something that the whole value of it is supposed to be that it's not a physical asset.
Yeah.
And obviously there's a lot in common there. And Bitcoin has been built, it was built to be a little bit like gold, so there's a limited supply every year in the same way that, so the amount of gold every year goes up by like about 1%, 1.5% from the amount we mine. So it's quite a slow increase. And there's a similar rate obviously for Bitcoin. So Bitcoin has been built to be kind of digital gold. I'd say that the sort of research says that it can be a safe haven. So I saw it described as a weak safe haven. So it won't always protect you. And I think the real problem with Bitcoin is so little data so far, right? And it's probably a slightly immature market, that it's still developing. The futures market for Bitcoin is quite new. So in terms of bringing in, so one of the problems before there was a futures market was that big regulated investors couldn't buy Bitcoin. So banking regulations and things like that meant that they weren't allowed to buy Bitcoin, but they were allowed to buy Bitcoin futures. And that's pointed as one of the reasons why the price collapsed back from when it got to $20,000 a Bitcoin. But it still makes it more mature, right? It brings in a whole new class of investors into it.
Yeah.
And it could easily be a safe haven. And it's, you know, it's a massive asset class now. It's still a lot smaller. It's still a lot smaller than gold. But it's growing all the time.
Prices
are obviously rising again now.
Yeah. I didn't know there was a futures market in Bitcoin. One thing about futures markets, though, they would tend to reduce the volatility in the spot market. Would that be correct? Or would it have an effect?
And they tend to improve price discovery.
Yeah.
So in any market, the futures market is usually, or a lot of the time anyway, depending on which one we're looking at, I suppose, but for a lot of them, if there's a spot market and a futures market, the futures market's frequently where the price discovery happens. I suppose some people in the gold market don't like the futures market, and I presume some people in Bitcoin don't like it. I wouldn't know it as well. And the reason is that they're described as paper markets, right? So you can trade gold futures, and you never have to buy an ounce of gold, right? You never have to physically own the gold. It does massively inflate the amount of gold trading that happens, because there's nowhere near enough gold in the world to deal with the amount of gold trading that happens every day. It's 145 billion a day gets transacted in the gold market. I think that's three days of trading is the total amount that gets mined every year. So it's money from one to the other, if you know what I mean. So I'm selling gold to you, you're selling it back to me another day. So there's a lot of churn between different people. With Bitcoin, I think it's a developing market. It should act a little bit like a safe haven in the long run, because it's been built to be a little bit like gold. And I think the more regulated it gets, and the less it's just a form of kind of dark money, and the more it's a real investment asset, the more safe haveny it'll start to get.
And would you see it as acting like gold in a portfolio, in the sense that it's because it's so volatile, it doesn't seem to be a very useful use of, you know, means of exchange. So, and people, it seems to be purely speculative at the moment.
But that's a bit like gold, but gold does have uses. So, gold is an investment asset, but a lot of that investment is actually purchased through jewelry. So, about 50% of all the gold in existence is held as jewelry. So even though it doesn't have as much of a use industrially as other metals do, it does have a massive use in terms of jewelers, and it has this central bank holding, which I think is quite important. So one of the things that stopped that slowed the rout in gold prices. So gold prices bottomed at about $250 an ounce, somewhere around 2000, and one of the things that kind of ended the decline in the gold price was central banks agreeing that they would slow their gold selling, that they'd stop selling gold so quickly, and they agreed to limit how much gold they were going to sell. And that kind of, and then since the global financial crisis, and they were kind of net sellers all the time a little bit. And since the financial crisis, you've seen a lot of countries buying more gold. So China, Russia, and then other smaller countries have become big gold buyers, and they've been diversifying their foreign exchange holdings by holding gold. So a little bit of it's kind of like anti-dollar. They don't want to hold dollars, but they want to have access to dollars, and gold gives you that.
Right.
But I think the difference is that there are real uses for gold, so it's not the same as Bitcoin. And it'll never be exactly the same, because gold does have these real uses. And there is a convenience yield to having it, so you can look at it. It's pretty. You know, if I buy a gold coin, I can put it on my shelf, and it'll shine in the corner for me, whereas my Bitcoin is only ever going to be a financial asset. Which is not, you know, it's not a negative. It's just a more specialized thing then. The gold market is is quite complicated. In one way, you have people buying it for jewellery. Then if the price gets really high, you have the kind of, you know, the cash for gold signs that were really common when gold prices were high the last time around 2011. Every shopping centre you went to, there was a sign somewhere on a shop door saying, you know, we buy gold. I saw my first we buy gold sign in a long time a couple of weeks ago on a street in Cork in Ireland. So, you know, gold prices are obviously getting high again. People are doing that. So, you know, people buying jewellery, then selling it when they want the money back. There's coins, then there's industrial production, there's central banks. So there's this kind of diverse group of people buying gold and interested in gold, whereas with Bitcoin, it is speculative. You can't use it really as a medium of exchange because the price, like you said, is just too volatile. I mean, gold isn't a medium of exchange. There's no way that you could use it. There are people who have gold-backed credit cards and things like that. Now you can put money in a gold account and then use your credit card, and when you spend it, it'll convert your gold into local currency and subtract it from your balance and all that. But it's pretty rare, and it's quite an expensive thing to do in terms of transaction cost.
Okay, so just moving on then, you've done some work on just, I suppose, the economic drivers behind maybe gold and other precious metals. Maybe you could tell us a bit about what would be the determinants of the prices of gold versus maybe other metals. We might have touched on some of these already.
Yeah, no, so the biggest driver of gold price is actually the real interest rates. So you earn a certain interest rate by, let's say, investing your money with the government, and then you subtract the interest off that to see what your increase in purchasing power is. And when real interest rates are high, so when giving your money to, you know, when lending your money to the government results in big increases in your purchasing power, gold tends to do badly, right?
So
it's just, you know, kind of the essential economic concept of opportunity cost. So the opportunity cost of owning gold is that you don't own, you know, another asset that has a yield. So, you know, if you usually gold gets compared to the yield on a government bond, kind of 5 and 10 year government bonds, and there's a big negative relationship between those two. So one of the reasons why gold prices rose so much around the financial crisis is you had falling real yields. You know, we had falling interest rates, and you know, so that meant that you were getting less real return on your investment after inflation. And again, now because so many countries have negative interest rates on their government bonds, the cost of holding gold kind of disappears. So previously people would say there's no point owning gold because, you know, gold just costs you money. But now your alternative is to buy a 10-year government bond that has a negative interest rate anyway.
Yeah.
So the one of the downsides of owning gold has kind of disappeared, and that's one of the reasons why gold has done so well. You know, over the last couple of years, you've had falling real yields, and the big rises in gold prices this year since March were coupled with big falls in real yields in the US. And gold has kind of flatlined for the last kind of month or so, around $1,900. And one of the reasons for that is that real yields have stopped falling, right? So that. If you kind of think of it as a trade-off, which will I do? The more real yields fall, the more you're encouraged to go and buy gold, and the more gold prices go up. So there's a really strong relationship there. You know, and you know, reading your tagline for the podcast, that, you know, it's just logic, and the logic is opportunity. You know, opportunity cost explains an awful lot of what goes on.
Yeah.
In human life and in economics. So one of the big drivers is real interest rates. There's probably, you can think about it then in terms of supply and demand. So if you were trying to price a share, you think about how much money the share would pay you in dividends, right? And you can't do that for gold because there's no income. So if you're going to think about gold, you have to think about it kind of in terms of your basic economics 101, supply and demand. And you've got to think, well, what will happen to prices long term from where you are? Well, supply grows really slowly. It grows at about 1% a year, and the supply is kind of falling. So a little bit like Bitcoin, you've got your supply is being choked off. I was just doing a bit of reading for the podcast just brushing up, and I'd forgotten that about 80% of all the gold we know exists on planet Earth has been mined by now. So there's only, you know, the amount that's left to get is quite small, and there haven't been any large gold discoveries for a couple of years. So supply is quite constrained,
right,
in terms of new supply. And then demand is growing because the fastest growing economies in the world, in China and India, places like that, are where gold is demanded. So another big driver of gold since 2000, you know, we had the, the price bottomed out there on $250, and it's been on a kind of a, it's been a good market ever since.
Yeah.
One of the reasons is China entered the World Trade Organization in 2002, and then there's a whole new set of buyers there. And Chinese gold demand kind of grows fairly, it grows pretty healthily, and Indian gold demand as well, as their economy grows. So the sources of demand are growing all the time. The sources of supply are shrinking. And if everything stays that way, you'd imagine long run gold prices would continue to trend upwards. The big risk to that scenario is that the, you know, Eastern buyers of gold do what we've done in the West and just get bored of it. So we don't really buy much gold anymore. Gold jewelry isn't, you know, people are more likely to buy platinum and silver jewelry, or it's becoming a more important market than gold in the West.
Yeah.
We've kind of gone off gold a little bit. If that happened in China and India, that would be obviously a big negative, then that big source of demand would disappear. So that's kind of where going forward you're looking at in terms of supply and demand. Supply is definitely going to be small, and if everything stays as it is and people in the East still keep buying gold for weddings and for investments and all the rest of it, that looks pretty positive for gold in the long run.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. When you mentioned there about the real interest rate, it got me thinking, if real interest rates are low, that would usually be in a time where, like now basically, where economic performance is bad. So you'd wonder, because they're correlated, are you able to disentangle the two effects?
They tend not to be disentangled, because it's the inflation number is obviously static enough. That's only measured monthly, right? Mm. And gold price is bobbling around all the time. People tend to be comparing on a daily basis then, because gold is a financial market and interest rates are a financial market. They tend to move a lot faster than the inflation rate does, right? The goods markets are a lot more sticky. So they tend not to disentangle the two very much. I have been doing a piece of work recently on this supply and demand issue. So trying to divide up gold into its various buckets, jewelry, recycling, dentistry, all that sort of stuff. And then trying to work out what the price, use it to explain the price. And kind of, like I said, in a kind of a simple economics 101 thing where supply goes up, price must go down, that type of thing.
Mm.
And one of the things I've come across is, so if you look at jewelry, one of the drivers of jewelry is economic growth. So jewelry demand is driven by how high the price is. If prices are going up, people are buying less jewelry because they tend to be quite price sensitive. But economic growth then is a big positive for jewelry investment and things like that. So one of the things we're trying to do is pull out how much economic growth affects gold prices in the long run. And there's definitely a positive driver there. The problem is it's quite persistent and small, whereas other things kind of shout it out. There's so much more volatility coming from investment and interest rates and things like that, that in the long run you can see that it's having a positive impact on gold prices. In the short run, it's hard to pull it out because it's such a noisy price, price goes up and down so much.
Sure, that makes a lot of sense. And we've talked a lot about maybe the market supply and demand effects. I know you've done research on the extraction costs and how that affects the price of gold. I wonder, could you tell us a few, the headline facts or what the message is there?
Yeah, so I mean, the thing for me, gold is unique compared to other, well, not unique, but it's fairly unique relative to other assets. And one of the unique things about it is how much of it there is just sitting in vaults in London and places like that. There's, I don't know, is there four or five stories underground under the Bank of England, which is just gold vaults.
Right.
So one of the things that argued was that gold miners, if the prices went too low, gold miners would cut their production, and that would drive the price back up. But that doesn't really make any sense. One of the things in economics you go on a lot about is the difference between stocks and flows.
Mm.
And gold is totally different to, let's say, copper. Copper, there's a very large flow, but there's almost no stock, because as soon as people buy copper, they put it into buildings and they put it into other stuff, so that the stock disappears. With gold, it's different. So for copper, you'd expect that as prices go, as costs go up, then the price of extracting copper will go up, because they'll have to be compensated for it, or else they won't supply enough copper, right? So if prices don't go up, they'll stop supplying copper. The price will go up then. and it'll all get back into equilibrium. But that doesn't work for gold. It's the other way around. Gold miners tend to react to the price. So when the price goes up, gold miners go after deposits that were previously economically unviable. So they were too deep, or they weren't, you know, you need, there's a certain amount of gold in the ore. So if there's not enough gold in the ore, it's quite expensive to get it out. And when prices go up, what's happened in the past is gold miners have gone after those more expensive deposits and they've driven up costs. So it's all kind of topsy-turvy and backwards for gold because of this difference in stock and flow. And even like silver is the same. Silver has a much larger flow relative to stock because it gets used up. Again, it doesn't sit in vaults in the same way that gold does. So it's a fairly, you know, it's a fairly unique asset.
Yeah.
And it's unique in terms of the long history you have on it. So you can get gold prices back to kind of 1200 AD for England and things like that.
Yeah.
Whereas it's the same thing that's being traded, where, you know, if you look at equities, you know, they weren't the same thing up until a certain time, and they're not anywhere near as old. And a lot of the companies, if you go back and you look at kind of equity trading in the 1700s, those companies are all gone. So you're not analyzing exactly the same thing, where, you know, gold, in a certain sense at least, has been gold forever if you have the price.
Yeah, that stock flow analogy actually is something I hadn't thought about before, which is actually really interesting.
Mm.
One thing then as well that you've worked on is like something that behavioral economists would be interested in, psychological barriers when it comes to different prices, and perhaps people treat maybe round numbers a bit differently when they see them than maybe uneven numbers, and that might affect investment behavior.
Yeah, and gold is, again, gold has another kind of weirdness there, where gold is normally thought of in terms of dollars, right? So everyone thinks if you hear about the gold price, they'll always tell you the dollar price of gold. And even, you know, if you ask me what the price of gold is, my automatic answer would be to tell you in dollars. But gold is, you can buy it in any currency. So a piece of research with a friend of mine up in Durham, Michael Lucy, and we looked at whether or not there's a psychological barrier in the price of gold, the kind of round numbers. So is there something special about gold going to $2,000 or $1,900 or anything like that? And there is. So as the price, the paper we call it Mind the Gap, because what we noticed was that those, if you look at the prices, round numbers don't really exist in the data set. So the price never really settles on 1900. It tends to get up to towards 1900, and then it either bounces off it, so it goes to like 18, you know, 99, and then it drops again, or else it goes 1899 and then straight over to, you know, 1903 or something, but it goes directly over the barrier. Like, it's like jumping a hurdle. And I suppose that makes no sense, right? There's nothing magical about $1,900.
Yeah.
And I suppose what's even more interesting is those barriers don't exist for gold in other currencies. So gold is traded in dollars, and it's thought about in dollars. But you can, if you're on the London market for gold, you can buy your gold in euros, you can buy your gold in sterling or yen or Swiss franc or whatever you want. People seem to worry about gold hitting, you know, if it goes over 1900 or it goes over 2000, they think maybe it'll keep going higher. You have this kind of feeling that once it gets over that resistance point or that hurdle, it'll keep going. But those barriers don't exist for gold in other currencies. So gold in euros, gold in sterling. There's no barrier at £1,000, right? Mm. There's no barrier at €1,000, where there would be a barrier at $1,000 for gold. So it's totally, totally psychological, right? It's totally constructed by humans, I suppose. And it's not just the gold market, where other markets have this kind of finding too, that the round numbers, you know, people ascribe more importance to round numbers.
So what does the round number cause people to do, or is there any insight into that?
So I think as the price starts rising towards 1900, you know, people are trying to assess whether they should buy more gold or whether they should liquidate their position. Are prices getting too high?
Yeah.
And I suppose what tends to happen is it gets to 1899 or whatever, it gets within an ace of the barrier, and then either people get excited and the price jumps quickly and goes, you know, way over it. So it doesn't go 1899 1900, it goes 1899 1905, because there's a rush of money into where people buy, or else it gets to 1899 and people panic and go, right, it's not, you know, it's not going to go any higher, this is as high as it's going, and they start to sell their gold and drive the price down. But it creates kind of I suppose it creates stress. That round number creates stress. There's a really good book about behavioral economics in relation to the body, the hour between dog and wolf, where he talks about the biological response of the body to things like this. So
yeah.
I think of it as you're stress induced around that point, and it causes you to either get overly optimistic and buy more, or else you become pessimistic and you sell your position before it gets to it.
That is really interesting. people pay more attention to the round number. It's probably why we set our alarm clock for a round number and things like that.
Exactly, yeah. 7 o'clock instead of 7, no more logical than 7.
Nobody sets their alarm for 7:01 or 7:02. Maybe just to wrap things up, how would people view a goal in terms of their investment portfolio at the moment, maybe especially considering we're in the middle of the COVID-19 pandemic and maybe post-COVID, for the average punter, how could they view gold?
Yeah, so in terms of the only investment advice I suppose I would give out is that gold is a useful diversifier. If you're building your portfolio, buying a certain amount of gold is a good idea. You shouldn't put an enormous amount of enormous percentage of your wealth into gold, because it's a really volatile asset. It goes through long periods of decline and then long periods of going up again. So it's not... You shouldn't be putting all your money in it unless you want to speculate, but it's always a good diversifier. In terms of investment, where you're trying to pick, where you're trying to pick a little bit and try and buy stuff that might outperform, to me, gold is in a pretty good place. So again, not investment advice, but if you look at the history of gold, so gold starts floating freely in 68, and it goes through one little bull market where the price goes from $35 up to about, I think it was about 200, and it dropped back down to 100. And then it goes through a massive bull market up to about $850 an ounce in the 80s. And then it goes through an awful bear market up to the 2000s. But you get these two run-ups, and the price essentially went from $35 an ounce to $850 an ounce, which is a massive increase in value, right? And we've had one bull market from the 2000s up to 2011, where the price went from 250 to 1900. Price went all the way back down to 1100, which is, again, it's paralleling a little bit what happened before. It doesn't mean it'll happen again, but at the moment it's not quite doubled. So based on historical comparisons, it could double from here, and it would still be a small bull market compared to what happened in the 1980s. And there's a lot of similarities as well about why the price went up in the 80s. There was financial innovation in the 80s, where in the late 70s the futures market comes into existence for gold. So in the early 2000s you had exchange traded funds set up for gold. So they're a way of buying gold that's really cheap. So you don't have to physically own the gold. You just basically buy a share in an exchange traded fund and they vault the gold and things like that. So there were kind of financial innovations that made it cheaper to buy gold in the late 70s, and the same since the turn of the century. There were also new markets that came on stream in the 70s. So up until 74, I think, it was illegal for Americans to own gold. They weren't allowed to own gold as an investment. Right. They'd been banned in the 1930s, and they were forced to sell all their gold to the government for $35 an ounce. And again, there's new markets in the late 90s. India became a bigger market for gold. They opened up the 2000s. China opens up as a market for gold. The two biggest countries in the world by population. So there's a lot of similarities in terms of why we've had a bull market since the 2000s. And to me, even outside of a diversifier, it seems like it might have higher to go. But that doesn't mean it'll be a smooth path. It went to 2000 and it's been down a little bit since then. It dropped to in the 1800s and now it's around the 1900s. So it's a very difficult asset to trade. It's very efficient. So in terms of basic finance theory, again, it's an efficient market. You can't predict the gold price with any degree of accuracy from day to day. But there's lots of positive drivers. Economic growth in countries that like gold is there, and then low supply. So to me, it seems like a decent investment. But I think the real argument for gold is to have a small amount in your portfolio for diversification, because in the long run, diversification is one of the better ways to protect your money and also to grow it, because you never know what the big asset will be. So if you put all your money into gold and it does badly, your investment goes goes very poorly. Whereas if you spread your money out, then you're lucky, you buy some Amazon back in the day when it was cheap and now it's expensive, or you buy some Apple by accident. And the only reason you're buying it is because, you know, you're diversifying. So diversification makes a lot of sense for investors.
Sure. Okay. Well, thanks, Fergal. That's sound advice, I think. And it's not advice. It's just a comment.
With the usual provisos you get on those ads for investment companies on the radio.
The value may go down as well as up, and et cetera.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, thanks a million, Fergal. That was really interesting. Thanks a million.
My pleasure. Thanks for the invite, Niall. That was really interesting. Lovely chat.
So thanks to Fergal, and thanks to everyone for listening. If you like what you hear, don't forget to check out the Patreon at patreon.com/@themargin. Thanks and all the best.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.